This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We're meeting on May 20th, 1987 at 5 o'clock p.m. in hearing room 343. This will be a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 847, House Bills 2314, 2724, 2304, Senate Bill 307, House Bills 2291, 2293, and Senate Bill 566, and a work session on House Bill 2298 and Senate Bill 219.
Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senator Wires and Fryer, here is the subcommittee. Mostly to take public testimony, but we're going to, I'm going to ask one witness on a bill that's scheduled for a work session to come up and testify. Senator Tro's here on Senate Bill 219 with a brief statement, and all I can say, Senator Tro, is if you've got enough copies there for all the members, why, I'll make sure that they have that before when we get to this later on the agenda.
Thank you, Chairman Fry and Senator Wires. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes, there are enough copies for everybody, and I hope they will take a look at what we have to say about Senate Bill 219. I'm Senator Tro from District 18, and I appreciate your giving me the courtesy of testifying on Senate Bill 219. Which I understand you have before you in work session. I want to speak in support of an amendment that was submitted by the State System of Higher Education to Section 3 of the bill, subsection 1, paragraph O. It's important that the public record disclosure laws not discourage academic research and inquiry, much of which must proceed with some assurance of confidentiality in order to give proper credit for research and publications to the faculty member who does the actual work. Research funded by private sources or other governmental monies, grants, or other programs place some reciprocal obligations on higher ed, confidentiality, especially in research which can lead to the issuance of patents, and that confidentiality must be maintained. These patents can also generate significant funds for higher ed. With higher ed dependent on private sources and other non-general funds for 64.2% of its total funds in the next biennium, it's important that we protect confidentiality in academic research, and I hope that you can adopt the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 219 that do that. Both Hewlett-Packard and Tektronix also are in support of giving that kind of protection to research in higher education. Tektronix, for instance, talks about the ability to access if other people had the ability to access certain kinds of research information while the research was in progress, it could lead to discovery of proprietary information that otherwise would not be available, and that kind of situation could discourage corporations such as Tektronix or Hewlett-Packard from entering into contract with research universities. So I think using your great wisdom and discretion, as you look at the bill and if you decide to go forward with it, I hope that you will amend the bill so that we can protect this kind of higher ed research. Certainly there's no desire to keep the end result of any such research from being published and to be made available publicly, but basically the desire of this amendment is simply to protect the research as it's underway, the project design and the research design, so that it won't be pirated away and the researcher has some guarantee that his work can proceed without somebody else scooping him or interfering in it in any way.
Okay, and Senator, do you have the bill in front of you there?
I do have it, I think, in the folder, yes.
Okay, if you'd look at page 3, I take it that your concern is addressed to lines 32 and 33.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
Right.
There's a proposed amendment?
There is an amendment proposed, and I think you have it, which would change that language somewhat. And if you could consider that amendment, I'd appreciate it.
Okay, Senator, any questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Oh, that's yours. All right, we'll return later to Senate Bill 219. And for the benefit of the audience, if you've got the printed agenda, that's pretty much, as far as I can tell you right now, the order that we're going to take these bills. If you wonder how these bills get scheduled in a particular order, it's done by my staff with my encouragement to try and get bills set high in the agenda to accommodate witnesses who are from out of town. So the farther away from Salem you are, the better your chances of being heard near the top of the agenda. That's the rationale for this. So we're going to start with Senate Bill 847. Is anyone here on any bill? Senate Bill 847, all right. Down on, all right, come up, please. Expecting Senator Hill to be here also, or do you know?
I thought he was going to be.
All right. If you'd like to wait, he might show up. Otherwise, you can go ahead.
I thought I saw him heading this direction.
He always comes.
Is he usually here?
Well, he usually comes.
Maybe I should wait until he's
well,
here.
Well, why don't you just wait a minute and see if he does show up? So we'll skip 847 for the moment.
This one's Rocky Berea's bill.
And House Bill 2314, and Representative Berea's here on that. And anybody else, Representative Berea, that you wanted to bring up with you?
Mr. Santos, please.
Good afternoon. Santos.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Last time I was here, I got kind of choked up, if you remember that.
Well, I hope it wasn't the members of the Senate committee that caused that.
No, I was deeply moved. I have given you some written testimony for your perusal, and let me simply summarize my written testimony. What House Bill 2314 does is codify the existing law. It's the Attorney General's opinion of 1977. And the opinion states that local police are prohibited from enforcing federal immigration laws. The intent of the measure is to ensure that only INS ensures federal immigration laws. Immigration laws are very complex, and immigration officers have highly specialized training. Local police are not versed in immigration law and have no specialized training in immigration law. The problems occur when local police try to enforce immigration laws is that they have a high fiscal impact on cities and counties. There is a change in priorities of law enforcement. There is an increase in litigation and insurance costs, especially for false arrests. There is an exacerbation of the jail overcrowding problem. There are also infringements upon a person's civil rights. Lastly, in light of the recent 1986 Immigration Reform Act, there is a very difficult time now to determine or ascertain who's here legally, illegally, or somewhere in between. We talked about that at the prior hearing, and the new law, the new federal law, has really given a cloud over here who's legally and illegally. So what I'm asking you is to codify the 1977 Attorney General's opinion. Let me make one more note what the bill does not do. It does not prevent local police from arresting aliens who are engaged in criminal activity. If an alien is engaged in criminal activity, I would like them to be arrested because they affect other people in a similar situation. And the intent is not to interfere with local police involved in criminal investigations. This bill passed House 54-3, and I would sincerely request your passage of the bill.
May I ask a question, Representative
Sure.
Brian? Suppose a person is stopped on a stop and frisk, or even probable cause, but the officer determines that there isn't any probable cause to make an arrest, but in the course of the authorized identification gathering process finds out that this person is indeed an illegal alien. Now, would this bill prevent that officer from taking that person into custody?
Yes, sir. Yes, Mr. Chair. That and the present policy with the Oregon State Police is they would not arrest him or her. They would just leave him alone. If there was a reason to arrest him, let's say driving without a driver's license, then they would arrest him and then call immigration.
Any other questions of Representative Rhea? All right, go ahead.
My name is Danny Santos. I'm representing the Hispanic Local Action Committee. It's my pleasure to be here before you. And basically, I've provided some written testimony on dated April 30th, and there you have copies of that. And it outlines the law and the problems that are encountered in this community, the Hispanic community. And basically, it's almost to reiterate some of the testimony provided by Representative Berea, but it's our belief that this being a civil law, the criminal sanctions are not a factor here, so that state, local, and county law enforcement agencies really don't have a confused role when they've tried to participate, and this time really shouldn't have a role in the immigration law, simply because it's becoming more and more complicated. I listed for you some case law regarding the infringements, civil rights violations that have imposed some financial concerns to communities because their law enforcement officials have tried to enforce this civil law. And that case law is continuing to grow. And I think our past testimony in the House from a number of law enforcement officials have cited the concern and have validated the concern in the Hispanic community that all too often immigration law is enforced among those who appear to be Hispanic. And I think that testimony shows and, again, validates our concern. Thank you.
Are you gentlemen aware of the letter that the Labor Commissioner sent to me regarding and proposing an amendment or not?
Mr. Chair, I'm unaware of that.
Okay. She's concerned that, well, her letter speaks for itself. You can take a minute and take a look at it there.
Mr. Chair, I have no problem with this amendment.
Okay. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We have Kelly. Yes, Senator Hannity,
Danny,
do you have a question?
Do you remember, didn't we just last session introduce a bill, and I'm confident it made it through, that prevented local law enforcement agents, police, from entering our schools and pulling out suspected...
I believe so. That was passed the last legislation about the confidentiality of school records.
Correct. Yes. Thank you.
Kelly Hagan, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kelly Hagan, Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'm here only really to bring to your attention the amendments to which the Chair already referred. I'm filling in for Marilyn Coffle today and really have nothing to add other than what's contained in the letter.
All right. Now, committee members will, I think, find that letter in the file with the proposed amendment.
I'd only emphasize that my discussion with the division people today convinces me that they would consider it a severe, if not fatal, restriction of our enforcement efforts in farm labor contracting if we were to consider a law enforcement agency under this bill.
All right. Thank you. Lee Erickson, please.
Chairman Fry, representatives of the committee. For the record, I am Lieutenant Lee Erickson, Assistant Division Commander of the State Police Criminal Division. I have written testimony before you. We are in opposition to the bill for a couple of words that are in Section 2. I would like to point out that the State Police, by written policy, does not involve itself in the enforcement of federal immigration laws. However, Section 2 would prohibit our ability to contact U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service during an investigation many times where an illegal immigrant is the victim of the crime. We have some examples, for instance, in Klamath Falls currently, we have an illegal alien who is the victim of a criminal homicide. We would like to be able to contact U.S. Immigration and find out if he had been ever under investigation, and might find out who his associates might be or a labor contractor, which are legitimate leads that we would normally follow up in the investigation of a crime. And that's our only concern about this bill, is the wording of Section 2.
Well, it would look to me like on line 10, I suppose one possibility is to strike the words beginning with the word if on line 10. Or do you have any other suggestion?
One other suggestion might be is that we would contact them to request investigative information with reference to persons named in their files, is that we would like to have that ability is all. And we wouldn't want to be restricted.
Representative Bria, do you suppose you could get together with, all right, fine. If you try to do that, then, get together with Representative Bria and figure out something.
Yes, sir.
Let us have it.
Thank you, sir.
All right. Well, that'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2314, and we'll return now. Senator Hill's here. We'll return to Senate Bill 847.
Oh, that's Senator Hill.
Pardon? Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do have one page testimony, which I'll read. I'm the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 847, and this is Ms. Bonnie Smith, who is a constituent of mine who brought a problem to my attention last year. The bill attempts to address a part of the problem. The bill expedites the process for forfeiture property purchased under a land sales contract when the purchaser has little or zero equity in the property. Currently, ORS 93915 requires a seller to give written notice of default to the purchaser under a land sales contract not less than 60 days before the contract will be subject to forfeiture. Senate Bill 847 would amend this section to allow notice of 10 days only when the purchaser has an unpaid balance of 100% of the purchase price, in other words, no equity at all. Mrs. Smith sold her home under a land sales contract in August 1984. The contract stated that the buyers agreed to pay rent until December 1984 and that earnest money was to be paid at the close of escrow no later than March 1, 1985. The buyers fulfilled none of these agreements, except that they paid rent until March 1985. After March 1985, they did not pay anything. They had no equity at all in the home, but were legal owners under law. Mrs. Smith lost over $6,000 in rent, taxes, and insurance premiums, and had attorney costs in excess of $3,000. Had Senate Bill 847 been in effect at the time Mrs. Smith sold her home, it would not have prevented all these problems. However, it would have expedited the process for forfeiture of the property to Mrs. Smith and assisted her in seeking more rapid resolution of the problem. The provisions of the bill would add to existing remedy for forfeiture under land sales contract. It would add that when the purchaser has an unpaid balance of 100%, there's a 10-day period from delivery of the notice to the time that forfeiture is accomplished. If the purchaser has an unpaid balance between 90 and 100%, that is, they only own up to 10% of the property, there's a 30-day period. And then the existing law would kick into effect. That is, where the purchaser has an unpaid balance on the land sales contract of more than 75, and I'm adding but less than 90, there is currently a 60-day period. And so on. Also, at the end, on sub 4, I'm suggesting the proceedings initiated pursuant to this new language have priority on the docket of the court of jurisdiction over all other cases except those given equal or greater status by statute. The purpose of this is that to accomplish a forfeiture is very difficult. landlord-tenant law does not apply in the case of land sales contracts. The remedy is the court, and the remedy is very slow and difficult. This would help speed up the way to resolve these sorts of problems, which causes a lot of financial hardship for the small person who's trying to sell their home by land sales contract. So I'd ask the committee to act favorably on the bill and try to help folks in this situation.
All right. Any questions of Senator Hill? All right. Senator Hill, did your constituent want to say anything?
Would you like to say a few words?
Yes. This
Just
was
tell us your name and where you live.
Bonnie from. Smith. I'm a real estate broker, and I'm an investor, small investor, very small, very small indeed after this. Under the current law, if you sign an earnest money, if a buyer signs an earnest money to move into a property and agrees to make a down payment at a certain time and does not make it, then there is no way that you can get him out of the property. Landlord-tenant bill does not apply. You have to go through circuit court. It takes 9 to 10 months to get the so-called buyer out of the property. It cost me thousands and thousands of dollars, and I had no remedies to enforce his even paying rent. And this might be remedied by putting a clause in a land sales contract to the effect that if the buyer does not live up to his obligations, then perhaps he would come under a landlord-tenant bill, or better yet, Senate Bill 847.
Okay. Mrs. Smith, the purchaser or prospective purchaser in the case you're telling us about actually sign a land sale contract or just an earnest money agreement?
He just signed an earnest money agreement, and he didn't follow through and do anything that he agreed to do.
You allowed possession, I take it, before.
I allowed possession on a rental basis for 3 months when he was supposed to make the down payment. And then I found out that he was a professional suit artist, and that he had learned about an old under the Supreme Court of Oregon, a judge had ruled 20 years ago that you cannot evict a buyer. And under that law or that ruling, then he could not be evicted.
Did you have legal counsel during your attempts to get rid of this person?
About $7,000 or $8,000 worth.
Senator,
yes.
The problem is the earnest money agreement has the same protections under the old court decision as an actual land sales contract. They're a buyer of the property, and they're considered to be in possession of the property and, in fact, owner of the property.
All right. Any questions? All right, Senator, thanks for being
Thank
here.
You.
And Ms. Smith,
appreciate
nice to
your
see
time.
You.
Thank you.
All right. Anybody else here on Senate Bill 847? Close the public hearing on 847. I'll go to a public hearing on House Bill 2724. And we have Thad Geyer. Yes, he's the one I called up here. So he's the one I called. Were you? Wait a minute. You asked me if I wanted to take another bill first. Oh well, sure. Representative Phillips is waiting in the wings. I'm sorry.
I thought you might be.
Okay. I didn't see you back there. What are you hunching down for? Everybody's afraid to come up here and look this committee in the eye.
I have a half an hour until I go into tort reform. I was kind of taking a break.
Oh, I see.
Getting warmed up.
Here comes another one.
Are you, which one are you here on, Paul?
2291, the additional judge bill for Washington and Clackamas County.
Oh, that bill.
Did you really have to ask?
That little Hummer you and I have talked about.
Okay.
Is that the county that's so efficient it hardly even needs a courthouse to get everything done?
We are so efficient, it's incredible. We make so much money for the state that one additional judge is going to make so much more. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Phillips, State Representative from House District 9. I'm here in support of House Bill 2291. It's a bill that we've worked rather diligently on with both the Clackamas and Washington County Bar and the State Bar Association to add additional judges for both Washington and Clackamas County. Originally, the bill was sent out with three judges for Washington County and two judges for Clackamas County. We worked with the Ways and Means Committee, realized that revenue and budgets wouldn't allow for that. So we were able to get authorization for one additional judge for both counties starting 1/1/88, and we're very pleased with that, plus some pro tem assistance for both counties. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and we'd appreciate any assistance in expediting that process. And with that, that's my entire presentation. If you want to hear all the statistics, you can, but I think you probably don't.
Well, I think it's probably been pretty thoroughly reviewed. Knowing how the process works on adding new judges in Oregon, I'm sure that the process works pretty well. Mr. Olson probably wants to tell us about that.
I would just say, Mr. Chairman, that this is a priority bill of the State Bar, and thanks to the tenacious work of Representative Phillips, we have progressed this far, and this will really improve the court processes in those two counties.
This do they still go through the bar convention process on these things, and this one
yes.
did?
Yes, both counties.
Now what are you chuckling?
Okay, any questions of the witnesses? All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, will you take a motion?
Oh, I'm not ready, Mr. Chairman.
I'll tell you what, I want you to understand that I told Senator Cohen, who's been excused tonight, that she went over the agenda with me, and I told her that I wouldn't do any work sessions on the bills that we hadn't heard before. And with my assurance, she said she would follow through on her other appointment, but I don't think she'd object to this.
That's certainly not for Clackamas.
You promise not to ask me about it anymore?
I promise.
All right.
I will no longer bug you on the bill.
I will no longer bug you on the bill.
Well, it's a good bill, and the chair will entertain a motion from Senator Hamby that we send House Bill 2291 to the floor due pass. Any further discussion?
Thank you.
Call the roll, please.
Brennan?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Cohen? Hamby?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Wyers?
Aye.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Brenneman.
Question on that. Should it go to Ways and Means before the floor?
I understand that has a subsequent referral, and it automatically will go to Ways and Means from this committee. All right. Now, shall we go back to 2724?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Diana Godwin with the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2724 is co-sponsored by the Oregon State Bar and by Thad Geyer, who's with me here today. Thad is a lawyer in Jackson County from Medford. Last session, during the 1985 legislative session, the Oregon State Bar requested that Mr. Geyer come to Salem from Medford to testify on a bill of concern to the Oregon State Bar. It was a bill concerning licensing of so-called legal scriveners. We asked Mr. Thad Geyer to come up to the Sunset Committee and share his experiences in handling some cases that had previously been handled by Scrivener Services. As a result of Mr. Guyer's testimony before a joint House and Senate Sunset Committee, he was sued for giving testimony to a legislative committee. That suit is presently pending in Marion County. And this bill, House Bill 2724, is an attempt to address the question in Oregon of immunity for a witness who testifies before a legislative committee. I've, as I said, asked Mr. Guyer to be here. I worked with him in drafting this bill, also worked very closely with Representative Stan Bunn from the House Judiciary Committee. And with that, I'll turn that over to Mr. Guyer.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Thad Guyer. I'm the director of the Center for Nonprofit Legal Services in Medford. The reason that the lawsuit against me for $2 million plus is still pending is because there is no Oregon statute or case law on this topic. A motion to dismiss was submitted to the Circuit Court of Marion County by our attorney, and there being the absence of law on that, at the Circuit Court was not willing to dismiss the suit. The issue that I'm bringing up appears to be, at this juncture, at any rate, isolated in Oregon to me, as far as any experiences I know of. However,
with a fairly broad spectrum from government, including two administrative agency heads, two hearings officers or referees, and then members from the private legal community. The bill requires no appropriation to be carried out, and we would specifically request that this committee lift the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The purpose of the commission would be to perform the study and report back to the next legislative session in 1989, and we would urge your support and speedy approval of this measure. Thank you.
Terry, did you have something?
Yes. Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm Terry Rogers from Legal Aid. And on behalf of individual legal aid clients, I am testifying in favor of House Bill 2304. We are also in support of the bills in this time creating a division of independent hearing officers. However, I think it's unlikely that that's going to happen. The issue has been before the legislature since 1977. Legal Aid feels that it is high time that the a commission be appointed so that during the interim, the issue can be really grappled with. And it really is a very important issue because it goes to the heart of whether decisions are really impartial decisions at the administrative law level. Our clients come into a welfare hearing and are faced with an employee of the agency holding the hearing. And they have a very hard time thinking that the proceeding is unbiased and that the individual will be uninfluenced by the pressures within the agency. And in fact, in the Adult and Family Services Division, the actual hearing decisions are reviewed by first the head of the hearings unit, then the income maintenance section, then the assistant administrator of the division, and sometimes the administrator of the division. One of the things that this produces is changed hearing decisions, and another thing that it produces is incredible delays. Last month, we had 19 cases that were beyond the time limit for deciding cases, which is 90 days. Some cases have taken as long as 8 months from the Adult and Family Services Division. Basically, we feel that the issue at hand is very important because it is not only a question of justice, but the perception of justice. The administrative hearings system is the day in court for thousands and thousands of Oregon citizens, not just poor people by any means. So I am delighted to be able to support House Bill 2304, which would set up a commission to grapple with the many issues involving this. I would like to also speak specifically to the issue of removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. In the House, there was a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and the bill was amended in several ways to take care of any issues of fiscal impact. I'd like to just go through with you why this has no fiscal impact at this time. The legislative per diem, and I am now on page 2, line 24, is to be handled in the separate legislative per diem account and does not have to be funded in this bill. The other members of the non-legislative members of the commission are to receive no per diem or expense requirements. Now, this may not be good public policy. However, in discussions with the Administrative Law Judge Association and others, we really felt that, first of all, we were told by Speaker of the House Katz that it was unlikely we would ever get the bill out of Ways and Means, even if the fiscal impact was very small. So we felt that since the bill only intended to pay minor expenses, travel, say, for non-legislative members, that the real cost of serving one's society and government by serving on this is one's time, and that nobody is able to do these things because they can get some mileage money. The people serve because they're dedicated to serve, and they aren't paid for their time, which is the real thing that they are giving. So we do have a removal of that in the bill. Finally, staffing was the other major issue, and legislative counsel has agreed to staff the commission and issue the report. So that, and Representative Springer, if you need something from him or from legislative counsel, we can provide that. I talked to him just before the hearing, and he assured me that legislative counsel had assured him in the House that this was included in their budget, and that there is a cap on the expenses in legislative counsel's budget of $1,000, which you see on line 29. So I do feel that the bill has no fiscal impact and would recommend that the committee move ahead with a do-pass recommendation on the bill and request that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be removed. Thank you.
All right. Questions? Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair, I would like to take the opportunity to recognize a gentleman by the name of Jim Connolly out in the audience. He and I were hearings referees together at the Department of Revenue, and he, in 1977, even though we were still employed there, he had the courage to bring this bill over to the legislature. I can't say specifically was against the wishes of the administration there, but it certainly was not with the approval. And we had the situations where, to give an example, in our income tax cases where an assistant attorney general will represent the department, and of course the order would eventually be signed by the director of the department, and of course the director's lawyer is also the Department of Justice. And he had the courage to bring this issue forth, and I think at the very least it is an issue that deserves a study, but I did want to acknowledge him there. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. Thank you. Bruce, somebody.
The last name is Black, Mr. Chairman. I'll reserve my testimony for 307. Thank you.
Okay. We may not get to 307 today. I'm taking a look at the clock and what else is left on the agenda. And let's see. You came from Portland?
No, Mr. Chairman, I'm local. There's no difficulty with that.
Oh, all right. Okay, thank you. All right, we're going to go to House Bill 2293.
This is sort of an all-bar day, Mr. Chair.
Is that why they have their photographer here today?
All right, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Diana Godwin, representing the Oregon State Bar. House Bill 2293 was adopted by the full bar membership at its convention last September, and it is designed to correct a defect that is inherent in having a dual-level trial court system as we do. Today, if you mistakenly file a case in one court, say the circuit court, and jurisdiction properly lies in the district court, and it is later discovered that is a jurisdictional defect and makes any judgment arising out of that case void ab initio. And if then when you learn that your jurisdiction is defective, if the statute of limitations has run, you are out of luck and you may not have the opportunity to file in the correct court. As in response to that, the Oregon State Bar has sponsored House Bill 2293, which very simply is designed to correct that specific problem. In the case of House Bill 2293, if a case is filed in the wrong court, as soon as it is discovered, the party, the case shall not be dismissed, but shall be transferred to the correct court, and therefore you do not lose jurisdiction, you do not lose your statute of limits filing date. That protects a litigant's claim where, as I said, the case has been filed in error. A case filed in district court can be transferred to the circuit court, and a case filed in circuit court can be transferred to district court. It avoids having to dismiss and refile. And that is all this bill does. It does not allow a party to, quote, forum shop, because it mandates that a party must make the motion to transfer the case as soon as the party becomes aware that a claim exceeds the jurisdiction of the court. Also, if the court becomes aware of that, the court on its own motion makes a motion to transfer the case. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Well, I'm trying to figure out if sections 4 and 5, is that that new language?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sections 4 and 5 are new language, Mr. Chair.
If I remember correctly, section 4 provides for transfer from circuit court to district court and parallels the language found in section 2, which provides for transfer from district court to circuit court.
Yes. Much of the language had to be repeated because we had to parallel it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And then section 5 is simply statutory instructions to the clerks of the court and requires them to transfer all the materials in the court file.
Okay. Section 2 is new. It's like it's kind of a different style, isn't it? Section.
Claim not within the jurisdiction. So there's a.
And you got this thing here, section. There are no references like that in the section.
To do with legislative council. I've asked him about that.
All right. Any questions by the committee? Okay,
well,
thank you.
I can see I really held your attention on this one. Thanks.
Okay. That'll close the hearing on House Bill 2293.
That's right. Judicial Department, after consultation, reached agreement with the debtor creditor section, and the bill is ready to go out.
Well, okay. We'll take up Senate Bill 566 now. There have been some proposed amendments, and so we're going to have some more testimony on these amendments now. And Brad Swank can come up. I
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm here representing the Oregon Judicial Department and from the State Court Administrator's Office. This bill is a bill that was submitted by the committee at our request that was introduced to make more efficient the garnishment procedures by establishing alternative procedures to allow attorneys to issue writs of garnishment directly and by providing other cleanups. The amendments that you see, numbered SB 566-1, LC 872, are amendments that we worked out with the bar to address some of the concerns that they had and to clean up other portions, among other things. The bill clarifies garnishment law. It provides more information to garnishees on the garnishment forms about what's happening. It provides and addresses some other problems and hopefully will make the garnishment procedure work better. Although we do not expand anybody's right for garnishment. The attorney-issued garnishment that's provided under the bill allows attorneys to issue garnishment, writs of garnishment, only in post-judgment situations where they already have a client who basically has a right to the money and who's been to court and decided on that. I was told by Mark Comstock yesterday, who is a member of the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, that I could represent to the committee that the debtor-creditor section of the Oregon State Bar, the executive board, has gone along with the bill as we've amended it. As you may have remembered in the hearing, they expressed some concerns about it. I also spoke to Frank Bronner, who lobbies for the banks, and he said that they have no objections to the concept. They like some of the ideas, think it might make garnishment work more efficiently. They do have some technical concerns that they would like to speak to us about, but they don't want to hold up the bill over that and are willing to speak with us in between when the bill is in the Senate and the House and see if there are things that need to be addressed in by amendment or they can be addressed otherwise. Basically, that's the bill. We've also presented a Senate Bill 566 as changed by amendments, incorporates proposed amendments May 20, 1987, that should show the amendments as legislative counsel has done them. And if there are any questions, I guess I can answer questions.
Any questions?
Did you read the bill as part of his testimony?
No, counsel.
Mr. Chairman, acting on the assumption that there may be some of you who don't read bills like you would a novel, there is in your file a 3.5-page memorandum dated May 20th, which outlines the provisions of the bill. It's not, I won't claim that it's complete, but at least lets you know what's in there and provides a basic guide to the contents of the bill. In the bill also there is a more extensive memo from Brad Swank to me, which talks about some of the history and purposes of the bill, which is also available. And I, too, talked to Mark Comstock, and he indicated to me that the debtor-creditor section is now satisfied with the bill. If I recall correctly, their primary objection at the time of the original hearing was the provision under attorney-issued writs that payment would be made to the attorney. If I understand Brad correctly, those provisions have been deleted, and all payment is now either directly to the creditor or to the court. And so their concern about potential ethical conflicts for the attorneys have been abated.
Any questions, Mr. Swank? All right. You may have to come back and respond later. Richard Bray, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Richard Bray. I'm the owner of Triple B Messenger Service in Salem. At the present time, I'm representing Oregon Association of Process Servers, which is 22-member unit strong. We immediately opposed the bill for a couple, three reasons. One is that when the garnishment is issued by the attorney, the court loses all control of any action on that judgment. For example, if the judgment is in the amount of $3,000 and the attorney issues garnishment on that, he could effectively collect $100 a time, and the court has no control, no knowledge, nothing in their docket book to show the status of that other than there was a judgment issued. Because of that, the trial court clerk loses all control of any debt after the judgment phase when it turns into the attorney. The trial court clerk will not be getting out of the garnishment business because you have the small claim which goes to a judgment by the private individual on the street who desires to garnish a bank account or somebody's wages to collect that debt. He is not going to want to pay an attorney $40, $100 an hour or whatever to issue a garnishment, which at the present time would only cost him $3 plus $12.50 service fee. There's no provision in the bill that addresses the fact that at the present time a private process server must have E&O insurance filed with the Secretary of State in the amount of $100,000. When that bill was put in and that became law, it showed the concern of the legislature for the fact that there is liability in garnishments. Although I'm sure that all the attorneys are self-insured, the liability is still there. Many times in delivering garnishments, we have noted that the trial court clerk has changed the figures on the garnishment itself because of errors made by the man making the garnishment. This is even in collection agencies, of where the collection agency, as you probably all know, watch everything right down to the penny. They're still making mistakes. I presume those mistakes will still be made even on attorney-issued garnishments. If the attorneys issue the garnishments, it will directly affect every taxpayer in the state of Oregon in their pocket. Why? Because they will no longer send garnishments to the sheriff's department to serve. Therefore, the sheriff's budget is going to go down, and as was testified to on another bill, the amount of money you're talking about is probably $100,000 per year per sheriff's department. Of course, that's going to equal out all over. And somebody's going to have to pick up the revenue for that $100,000. And who's going to pick it up? It's going to have to be the taxpayer. We find in delivering garnishments that the garnishee is very particular about whether he accepts them because he knows the liability is there. So one of the first thing he does is he checks for the court seal. If the court seal is there and the signature is valid, then he accepts it. But if the court seal is not on an attorney-issued garnishment, I'm sure you're going to have a lot of trouble of people for a long time accepting those garnishments. If the court seal's there, they'll accept them. I think you have a letter from Capital Investigation Company Limited in your file. We support that. Capital Investigation Company Limited is a member of the Oregon Process Server. Also, Pat Garner from District Court Administration for Multnomah County is on record as in opposition to this bill. Also, the U.S. Bank and Legal Aid in Portland is opposed to the bill, as per Pat Garner. Any questions?
Questions? All right, yes, Senator Wires.
The committee assistant passed out a Oregon Association of Process Servers when you started testifying. I assume that means you brought it up?
Yes, sir. I brought that with me just to show you that the diversified people that are in the Oregon Process Servers organization.
Why is my friend Al, friends Al and Jason Crow marked out? Did they drop out of your organization?
Al Crow has sold his business to Jason, and Jason has renamed it to Nationwide so that he's got Al out of the business.
That'll help me when I get back to my law practice. It takes me a while to get reoriented here. The real question I wanted to ask you was, you've given a lot of good testimony, and I find that process servers frequently know more about some of these things than a lot of lawyers, sometimes including myself. But the thing you haven't covered, or if you did, I missed it, is what. Let's just talk about the economics of this for you guys. How is this going to hurt you? Do you think the lawyers are going to not use you to serve them?
If you mail it, absolutely not.
Oh, you think they might just mail them?
Sure.
Is there language in the bill that says they could do that?
The language of the bill is that they do mail them.
Oh, I see.
Mr. Chairman. Yes, counsel.
Service by mail is an alternative, as is, incidentally, issuance of the writ by the attorney. They're provided for people who want to use them, but personal service is still available.
Economic-wise, of how it hurt the process server depends upon his amount of garnishments. Now, if he works for a collection agency, and I'll just name one here in Salem, Valley Credit puts out a horrendous amount of garnishments because most of their cases go to judgment and end up in garnishment. So that person who is doing Valley Credit's work would be hurt. There are other process organizations that do not have a collection agency, and they just do very little garnishment work from attorneys.
Strikes me that would create kind of a mess if you did it through the mail rather than personally, but I don't have any preconceived notions about this, so thank you very much.
Okay. All right, Mr. Bray, thanks for being here. Jack, let's see now. Let me call, Jack Moore, please.
Thank you, sir.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Jim Swanson. I'm standing in for Mr. Moore. He could not be here this afternoon, or this evening, I should say. I represent Lincoln Credit Services in Portland in opposition to this bill, and I would like to point out some of the reasons why I feel that it is a bad bill with respect to let alone collection agencies, but small businesses in general.
Is this the statement now of Mr. Moore, or is it your statement that you've handed out?
It's my statement, sir.
Okay, Lynn, I'm sorry, sir. Give me your name again. You're not on my sign-up list.
Jim Swanson. Mr. Moore and I are partners, sir.
Okay, are you with the Lincoln Credit also, is that it?
Yes, sir.
Jim Swanson. Okay.
we take exception to the Section 3, Subsection B, Subgroup B, wherein the clerk of the court is not responsible for verifying amounts set out in the writ of garnishment. This would put an unreasonable burden on the small businessmen by removing the full power of the court in enforcement of its own orders, thereby making each and every writ subject to unreasonable challenges by the judgment debtor, which can only be resolved by summary hearings before the court. This course of action would only serve to further burden the court's already strained schedules. I have been in the debt collection business for 25 years here in Oregon, here in Salem for a while. The last 20-some years in Portland. I have never had occasion to have a garnishment scrutinized by the garnishee defendant or the judgment debtor himself. when it carries the court seal and the validity of the court, saying that these figures are what is owed. It's an abstract of the court records, and this is the amount that's due. I've never once had one of those documents challenged in and of themselves. I have had them challenged as to validity of service, saying, well, they served Mary Jane, the clerk in the office, and she wasn't authorized to accept service, so we're not going to honor the writ, and thus and so. But I've never had them challenged as such. I can envision, based on my years of experience and some other portions of this bill, whereby that they will invariably challenge 50% of the writs that are issued covering a small, relatively small consumer debts, such as the $300 doctor dental bill, the hardware store, bad checks, what have you, which is the backbone of an agency's activities. The second portion is subgroup E, wherein each writ must include a notice to the defendant that he may contest the writ's incorrect figures by filing a claim of exemption. If all other portions of this bill were to be approved, this is the one that should be taken out of this document. And the reason for that being is that it specifically states that the judgment debtor can ask for an exemption hearing challenging the validity of the garnishment anywhere from the time that it is served on the garnishee defendant for 180 days subsequent to that time. That is 6 months. So in theory, this is what, in my opinion, based on my years of experience, will happen in more instances than one would like to contemplate. And that is that John Doe finds his wages garnished for a $240 doctor bill, if you will, or he didn't pay for the lawnmower repair, or whatever you have in this range, $300-$400. He finds his wages garnished. He is aware, by virtue of the statement that has to be included and mailed to him by the service organization, whether it be the sheriff or the private process serving company, advising him of his right to file a claim of exemption and have a hearing in court challenging the validity of that writ. This can only foster the legal aid, your government attorneys, to file these types of challenges. It's burdensome enough to fend them off already, what with the truth in lending statutes, the many Miranda laws and so forth that have to be complied with already. This only poses another burden, and it not gives the opportunity to legal aid to challenge these things.